I've helped my customers become a better player than me. You know, I used to be a good drafter. I teach them how to draft. Now they'll outdraft me. You know, that's the fabric. It is a community. You grow it, you foster it, you steward it. That's what we're here to do.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Match Lip Podcast. My name is Frank. I'm your host of the Match Lip. On today's episode, we're going to be talking to store owner Jimmy of Dice City Games. Before we get into that, I just want to remind all of you listening that if you haven't checked out our previous podcast with Gamers, Geekery, and Tavern out in Cary, North Carolina, I highly suggest you give that a listen and then come back and listen to this one. And without any further ado, I'd like to welcome Jimmy from Dice City Games onto the show. Jimmy, how are you doing today?
I'm great, man. I'm excited to have recently discovered your podcast and looking forward to talking about all the things I love.
Likewise, I'm happy to have you on the show today. So what could you tell us, Jimmy, about your relationship with gaming and how you got into the gaming industry as a whole?
Oh, man. Okay, that's huge. I'm a bit of a storyteller. That's the Irish in me. But I got into gaming when I was very young. I was very lucky to have, you know, my parents were into sci-fi and horror and, you know, fantasy. You know, I grew up with Irish mythology. I read The Hobbit, and I heard about Dungeons and Dragons and Warhammer. And I'm actually one of the people, I haven't really heard many other people speak on this, but I really believe Magic has a close relationship to Warhammer and the hobby games that preceded it. In part, that's because some of the greatest Magic artists of all time, like Ian Miller, were actually for many years more famous for their Warhammer art. You know, you had the Hildebrands do D&D art. I think Magic players, because our game is so venerable and so unique in its success and, you know, the Pro Tour and the DCI and everything that makes it Magic the Gathering, I think we often sort of isolate it in our minds. But to me, Magic was one of a sort of a sea of games I got exposed to. So when I was young, I had a brief period of time where I was in a wheelchair. I had a sort of a degenerative bone disease that I've luckily been able to manage and overcome. But I would spend a lot of time reading, playing games with my brother, Sean, and, you know, ended up turning into a pretty robust kid. We played football in the neighborhood. And then one older kid one day was like, "Hey, I'm playing this game called Warhammer. You guys got to check it out." Now, what's crazy to think, I bought my first Dwarven Warhammer miniatures when I was 7 years old. So this would have been 1988, the early days of Warhammer Fantasy Battle, third edition. And this guy was brilliant. He ended up getting a perfect SAT score and going to Harvard, Yale, and Georgetown Law. But anyways, this brilliant kid who had this like great strategic mind named Nick Gettert brought us along and showed us Warhammer. And pretty soon our whole neighborhood gang, who were used to collecting baseball cards and playing football and hockey in the street, started playing Warhammer. And from that, while we're reading books like The Hobbit and, you know, exploring, you know, C.S. Lewis and the Chronicles of Narnia and all that, we ended up getting into, you know, collecting, painting the miniatures, building armies. And, you know, when you're a regular kid, you've played chess, checkers, maybe Risk. But Warhammer is so next level for an 8, 9, 10-year-old, 11, 12-year-old. By the time Magic comes out in 1993, we already have a sense of building your army, which is like building your deck. Points and restrictions, which is like the B&R list, and the tournament structure. We played little mini Warhammer tournaments on our friend's pool table. And, you know, so I think that when we saw some of this art and this fantasy, if you look at Dwarven Warriors from Alpha, he looks almost exactly like the Dwarven Warrior mold that had just been introduced by Games Workshop and Citadel Miniatures at the time. If you look at just so many of the early spells and creatures of Magic, they have direct parallels in Warhammer. Whether that was intentional or on the subconscious of the artists and the people working on Magic, we really felt it. So we kind of played Magic and Warhammer, and all of our collecting energy started to switch to Magic. So I would say from the beginning, I was a gamer at some level. And with Magic, that sort of niche I had for strategy games and collecting, be it Warhammer miniatures or baseball cards, comic books, and Marvel cards, just Magic was like the perfect combination of everything I loved.
And at what point in time did you realize that you wanted to open up your own store to offer these types of games? Was there a certain moment in time that it kind of hit you and like, oh yeah, I think I want to do this?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the neighborhood gang that I hung out with, we joked that one day we would open a game store and like live in an apartment above it. And that was sort of our like adolescent, teenage fantasy, you know, 13, 14, 15, talking about that. Over time, people start saying, Jimmy, you should be the one to do it. I just kind of put that in the back of my mind. You know, I ended up graduating high school, going off to University of Maryland, and I'm a Maryland boy, you know, DC, Maryland, Virginia guy. I've been here on and off my whole life. So I went to college, got into, you know, girls and punk rock, and I became a vegan, and I did all kinds of things that really took me away from gaming. I saw the world through a very serious lens. I was like a young activist, and I worked all the time, and I was in a band. And so I just started running out of time for gaming. I drifted in and out of every once in a while, I'd pick up some Magic cards or play a game with friends, but I really had quit all of that by my late teenage years. And eventually through my professional life, I worked in restaurants and grocery and retail and filmmaking. And so with my degree in American Studies and Media Studies, I got into documentary filmmaking, and I worked on some historical documentaries, some music videos, a couple indie, like little horror films with my, you know, friend group, and ended up, you know, even working on some award-winning documentaries for, you know, PBS and WETA, the local public television. And from there, I was just working so much, you know, between my time as a filmmaker, my time as a restaurateur, managing a restaurant in downtown DC. And I had been in on the ground level, a lot of these things. So they weren't startups in the true like .com finance, you know, tech sector manner, but a lot of the businesses, I would be the manager of a startup and maybe I'd have a small share in it or something. Like the restaurant was the first full service restaurant in DC with a bar and stuff to do vegan, dining, not like carry out. There were a lot of vegetarian kind of carry out ethnic restaurants, but this was a, you know, full service vegan dining. We had the first, I think, organic bar, you know, it served alcohol and had a juice bar, you know, and I was working 65, 80 hours a week. And that parallel had just kind of run in other businesses. After I left the restaurant, I helped open a men's clothing store that was like eco-friendly, sweatshop free, had like vegan Doc Martin boot alternatives, all kinds of stuff. It was cool. It was retail. It was things I was passionate about. But at the end of the day, it was taking me away from gaming still. And eventually I said, you know, what if I opened my own business? What would it look like? Would it be a restaurant? Would it be a catering company? Would it be a retail store? Would I open a video production studio? I thought about a lot of things. And I was reconnecting with gaming through a group of friends. We played a little board game, a little Magic, a little Warhammer. And in that time frame, that's when I decided to open Dice City Games. And I had a friend in that group who like believed in everything I was doing. He liked the idea. His name's Jesse. He invested, you know, got in the ground level. And now he's our director of online commerce and sales. But I had him and a few other friends just really believed in my like community organizing ability, you know, my ability to bring people together, whether it was parties or cooperative businesses, or the restaurant was like a meeting grounds. All kinds of people would come in and hang out and have a social scene. And so through those things I had done, people were like, you know, you should really open a game store. You should really open a game store. And in about 2015, I, you know, started writing the business plan and talking about it and came up with the name Dice City Games. In 2015 to 2016, we actually started doing pop-ups showing off what it would look like. And that was because I knew I wanted to be in DC. And there's this old sort of like punk / counterculture thing of just naming your city, right? So you've heard names like Charm City, Chocolate City, Murder City for different East Coast, you know, cities and so on. And the city that reads and stuff for Philly, you know. So I thought of DC, people were calling it, and my punk friends were calling it Damage City, Dead City. I thought those names were too negative, but I knew DC had a lot of nerds, and everything from the street culture of playing dice games to the like, you know, the, you know, Georgetown students playing magic tournaments on the weekend, or the AU students. I was like, you know, we're Dice City. So I just kind of dubbed it as a moniker for DC. And we rolled from there. And, you know, I just decided I'm going to parlay my personal collection, some savings, and this idea into a game store. So it was the best at everything I did professionally, you know, opening a business, managing it, marketing, hiring people, training, you know, retail and hospitality. And it was the best of my collection and the things I loved, you know, which was primarily Magic, but a little bit of other tabletop games, board games, D&D, and retro video games.
And how do you recall those early days of the store itself? What were like some of the trials and tribulations you faced, some of the positives that came out of it early on, compared to how you see things with the store at this point in time?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, Dice City Games came out at a time that was a very interesting time. You know, there was a lot of popularity in Magic. I think Magic saw a surge after Zendikar, but really the surge, and this is where I got back in, was sort of after the new Phyrexia, Scars of Mirrodin, Mirrodin Besiege block. So it was basically like M11 into Innistrad, you know, M12, the Return to Ravnica block. There was this really golden era of Innistrad and RTR block and Theros block and that sort of thing. And Magic was just growing and growing. And at the time, old school Magic hit the US. And I was one of the first people to play that on the East Coast. I won the first East Coast tournament that I'm aware of, which was outside of Eternal Weekend. There was an Eternal Weekend tournament. And then there was a second Eternal Weekend tournament that I did pretty good in. And a few weeks after that, some guys I knew in Philly put on a tournament with a Time Twister as the prize. Only eight of us registered. I think six or seven ended up playing. We played round. I think I played five rounds or something, played basically everyone I could. And in the end, I was the winner. And I declined to take the Time Twister. Now at the time, a beat up Time Twister was only a few hundred bucks. I was like, we need to save this for a future tournament. You know, old school is going to be the next thing. We got to grow this 93, 94 format. So I declined the Time Twister. I kind of regret that today because the guy eventually, instead of putting it back in another prize pool, he just sold it. But that was a really fun time to be playing Magic. I was playing with my friends, like I said, with Jesse, with a guy named Joel Sadowski, who I ended up sponsoring for a period of time. And he ended up playing on the World Magic Cup team for the US. And other friends of mine and friends of Joel's and Jesse's, like a guy named Vince Ferralo, we've sponsored him. You know, Jarvis Yu was playing in the local scene. Now I sponsor him. Dave Long, Kurt Spice. These are all guys who are just putting up great numbers. The DC Baltimore community was very competitive. One of my friends, a guy named TK, they just ended up winning the Legacy North American Championship, I guess, at Eternal Weekend a few weeks ago. And TK was in the same, you know, broader play group. And, you know, we sponsored them for a while. And just basically in those early days, it was just this really fun, really communal, but also really competitive sort of DMV Magic scene between Baltimore and DC. And I had a friend named Jason Cho, and he owned a store that was called Squabbles. And then that evolved into MDG First. And then he sold it to another sort of acquaintance friend, a guy named Bernie McKino. And then I got to know Bernie better. And he asked me if I wanted to help with some cons. So I went on the road with him, helped at one or two cons. And then very quickly, I was like, I'm ready to do Dice City. You know, we had our own booth. It was very popular. I think it was GPDC, I want to say 2016. And then in the fall of 27, we opened right before Black Friday. And, you know, I was very proud of it. I felt a lot of good community support right away. A lot of the people who were telling me, open a Magic show, move a Magic, they came out, they put their money where their mouth is. They played FNM with us. You know, we started hosting weekly Legacy almost right away. And that was really embraced by the community. And then pretty quickly after that, weekly Modern, you know, Draft, Commander. I think we were one of the earliest stores to really, really take Commander seriously. So there was so much good in those early days, but like any other startup store, you've got rent to pay, you've got bills, you've got a, you know, you got a tough landlord, you know, we're in a kind of urban environment. Like I love our area. Technically our street address is in Silver Spring, but really we're on this town called Wheaton, which borders Silver Spring. They're both DC suburbs. And we're on the metro. That was very important to me. I wanted to be accessible to the city. People could take the train, you know, the bus, whatever, to get to our store. But parking's limited because it's like a downtown central business district. And, you know, it's just like we're carving our own thing out. And a lot of the game stores in the area were in the suburbs. There were very few urban game stores. And there was literally one other that opened as a high-end puzzle board game shop that eventually ended up doing Magic. But we were kind of taking the helm as the, like, kind of urban game store in the DC area and for Magic especially. And that had its challenges. People had to find us, you know, and they had to learn us if they were new to the game. And, you know, there were these like really good players coming in and then brand new casual players coming in. So Dice City was sort of a meeting grounds for all these people. And it was a blessing. You know, I think the country, I don't want to get into politics too much, but the country was a bit torn at the time. You got to think about this November 2017. There's a new president. There's a resistance to him, you know, and we really wanted to be a place for common ground. You know, people come in, forget the politics, forget their work, forget the things, and just really be welcoming. And people adopted that very quickly. And I always hear like your store is the most welcoming. Like I feel at home, you know, what you guys are doing is like really good for me or my son or whoever, my daughter. And that's just been beautiful. So like any store, all the obstacles of being in a new, you know, a new place in life, a new location, you know, a new social political climate, all of those things happen. But, you know, other than like that early, like I said, struggle you have to pay the bills, things were really good. They embraced us. And we really, really grew at a phenomenal speed from 2017 through 2019. I think it culminated in Command Fest 2019, which was in, you know, they call it, Command Fest DC, but really it was, it's in Northern Virginia. But either way, huge turnout there. We had the professor come by our booth. We had Sheldon Menery come by our booth, rest in peace. You know, we had the first, really that I'm aware of, the first sponsored Commander player, a guy named Charles Zhang, who's known as Evaldi or the Mono White Mage or the Mono White Guy. He's a great player who wrote articles for us and stuff. And we had the room filled with players. I mean, everyone was wearing the red and white Dice City shirt with our dice on it. I mean, I counted at least 18 people, our sponsored players, employees, friends, just people buying shirts and coming up. Our booth, you know, people were saying, your booth is as popular as Star Cities, you know. I don't want to say that. Star City is always going to be the most popular booth at their own event. But our booth was, you know, we did an island for the first time, and I brought a really crazy piece of magic history. I brought with me an uncut beta artist proof sheet, or what we call limited edition artist proof sheet. And I just bought that from one of the early playtesters slash almost co-creator of the game, Richard Garfield's good friend, a guy named Barry Reich, who went by the moniker Bit in the early days. He was the lead alpha playtester. He was the set designer for an unreleased set called Spectral Chaos. And he just came into our shop to game and have his son play D&D. And we started talking, became fast friends. I ended up, you know, spending a fortune on this sheet. But we had a beta sheet at our booth, and, you know, sealed revised boxes and just artifacts of Magic's history. And people kept coming up, cosplayers taking pictures with us. And we were on top of the world, and parlayed that into 2020. And then you've got what ended up being some of our big tournaments over that winter. We held the Old School Winter Ball, which was very popular. In 2019, that had the artist Jeff Menges and some of the original playtesters from the early days came out. We made an awesome playmat that was sort of an ode to Swords to Plowshares, where the guy is holding a shovel instead of a scythe. And then, you know, we ended up having a large early spring, late winter event. I guess it's winter. February 20th, we held the revised Legacy Open, which was our own take on Star City had stopped doing Legacy Opens, and we were going to have our own. And I think it capped at like 120 players. It had a day two old school event. It had an Ice Age sealed event. We had a completely packed house at this brewery we rented just outside of Washington, D.C. And then 3 weeks later, the country was shut down. So that was a wild time to be at the sort of peak of developing a brand and a business. And then, you know, out of nowhere, we're in lockdown, and, you know, we're not even allowed to have a single pod of Commander players in the store. So to go from holding these 125 player tournaments and having artists and set designers and pros and sponsor players left and right, playmats, t-shirts, you know, just, you know, love from around the world, people visiting Dice City from Sweden, Lithuania, Peru, Japan, you know, and then all of a sudden it's like, hey, I guess we're going to sell booster boxes of, Ikoria online. I guess that's what we do now, you know? So we adapted and we survived, but, I would say that was the second chapter of the early days of Dice City and how wild and challenging it got.
So with being in Silver Spring, I know you mentioned that's the town in Maryland that you guys are in, being downtown. Mm-hmm. What is the proximate ratio of players that are coming to you guys from Maryland as compared to DC, which it seems like you may be closer proximity to compared to, say, yeah, you know, other major towns within Maryland? Like, what is that ratio of players you see?
Yeah, that's a good question. So DC is a really interesting city. It's sort of famous for having a large population during the day and then less people at night, because a lot of people come into DC for work who live in the county surrounding, like Montgomery County, Prince George's County, Arlington County. Those are, you know, Maryland, Virginia. People just, Fairfax County, you know, they drive into DC, they slog through the Beltway, they go home. So because of that, even a lot of people who sort of identify as Washingtonians really do live in the suburbs. So I'd say we're about 1/5 true DC, you know, Washington, DC players that, like, you know, drive down or take the metro or whatever. And I'd say we're at least, you know, 4/5 probably Marylanders. That said, somewhere in that math, maybe we're 1/5 DC, you know, 1/10 Virginians. I mean, people cross the state line to come play at Tri-City every day. You know, I'm one of them now. I bought a home with my new wife last year in Virginia. And so I do the slog of a drive. But, you know, it's worth it. You know, there's something special about Silver Spring as a town. It's very diverse. It's very accessible. It's right outside of D.C. And Wheaton is like, you know, the sort of last leg of Silver Spring. That's just this cute little downtown with tons of little restaurants and tattoo shops. And it's famous for having quirky retail. Before Dice City Games, there was a store called House of Cards, which moved further out in Silver Spring. But that's like the number one sports card store in the DMV. And then we had a store called Barbarian Comics. And Barbarian is sort of like an unsung hero of the comic industry. It was, it is arguably the oldest comic book store in America. Some people consider it the second oldest because it changed its operating name from Bonafit Books to Barbarian when the couple that owned Bonafit Books split it up. And basically the man, a guy named Carl, took the comic side of the business and the wife took the book side of the business, and both kept operating out of the same building. One was upstairs, one was downstairs. More or less, they were, you know, operating as Barbarians since something like 76, but something like Bonafit Books since like, I don't know, 64 or something like that. So this is either the oldest, second oldest, you know, comic book store in America, and it's in my humble town of Wheaton. We had a famous punk record store called Phantasmagoria Records for years. And there were other record stores in Silver Spring and Rockville where a lot of important bands came out of, like people who were in bands like Fugazi and Minor Threat, you know, worked in and recorded in like Rockville, like maybe 10 minutes down the street from Wheaton. So it was a really cool area for eclectic retail. There was a store called the Toy Exchange that did retro video games and trains, model trains, and toy action figures. So we were a natural fit for Wheaton's quirkiness. But if you're in DC, Wheaton's truly a suburb. But if you're in Wheaton, you feel like you're a Washingtonian. So it's hard to say, you know.
It's still very cool that you have the ability to pull from various markets, from DC to Maryland and Virginia, you know, with the metro essentially touching all those areas. And it brings you that larger player base potential that other stores might not have the luxury of having.
Yes, exactly. And that was part of the gamble. You know, it's not cheap to be in Montgomery County, Maryland. It's one of the 8 most expensive counties in America. You know, it's, you know, everything comes at a cost. And it's not that nice for being that expensive. I love Montgomery County. I've lived here. I lived there most of my life. Now I live in Fairfax. But ultimately, you know, it is great because you're outside the nation's capital. You're not that far from West Virginia, from Pennsylvania. You know, for our larger weekend tournaments, we get people from those places too. You know, Richmond's a little over 2 hours away, Charlottesville, 3 hours away, Baltimore's, you know, 30, 40 minutes, you know, an hour if there's bad traffic, but Frederick, Maryland, you know, all kinds of places come for our bigger weekend events. We actually have pre-releasers. This is one of the things I'm most proud of. We have a group of pre-releasers that come down from New York. I believe they come from New York City, which is crazy to do that drive on a Friday night, but they liked our pre-release so much, you know, that they would come down and pre-release with us. You know, we see them now and then, but pre-pandemic, they were here all the time. And I'm just like, that's so cool, man. Like, because when I was opening Dice City, I went to New York City and I looked at some of the stores there for inspiration. There's a really great store in Williamsburg called the 20-Sided Game Store, a great store in Long Island City, Astoria. I think it's called Geekstoria now. It used to be called, I think, the Geekery. And I looked at stores there and I looked at other stores around the country as I traveled for cons and stuff and to play Magic, you know, because I played a little bit competitively. And so I would always check out the local game stores. And, you know, I love the stores in New York City. The 20-Sided Game Store had little boutique glass soda cans and hot tea and stuff like that. And I brought that to Dice City. You know, with a restaurant background, I really wanted a kitchen, like, you know, Mott's Boarding House eventually, you know, opened and has an awesome kitchen on the West Coast by Card Kingdom. But I wanted to do that in D.C., but Montgomery County is not crazy business friendly when it comes to, you know, opening a restaurant. So the permits and stuff, we decided to skip it. But we've got like little gourmet chocolates and dry foods and like drip coffee and, you know, kombucha and stuff. And all the time I hear people say, wow, you've got the coolest soda or snack selection I've seen at any game store. So shout out to the New Yorkers that inspired that and now come down and enjoy our wares when they're here.
I mean, that is truly incredible that people are driving from New York City out to your pre-release, you know, at the time. That shows quite the impact that your store is making from a positivity standpoint.
Yeah, thank you.
And, you know, one of the things that you said, Jimmy, that really caught my attention, because you don't hear many stores running legacy events these days. And I really like knowing that you do that. I mean, Legacy is a format I do like myself. So I was curious how you were able to cultivate the community around that and how that popularity and demand for it came about when you see, you know, other, you know, stores like Star City Games or even other smaller game stores across the country, that the ability to run those types of events isn't maybe, say, as profitable as it once was.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I'll tell my story. Obviously, it's not prescriptive, so I can't tell people in smaller towns areas what to do. But I think at its heart, I was a Legacy player at the time. And I still identify as being a Legacy player, though I rarely get to sleeve up a deck. But it's an important part of like how I approach Magic. I love that Magic has formats like Legacy and Vintage, where you can play cards from any era. Because when I first played, I was very lucky. I started with Unlimited, played in 93, 94, early 95. I actually quit before Ice Age came out, took a long gap, came back with like the Urza's block era, took another long gap, came back with the Invasion block era, and so on. I would take these long breaks. And I think that as I held on to my cards, even when Modern and Legacy really were like dueling for popularity in the DC Baltimore corridor, when Modern was already popular in certain places, more so, I think Legacy really was more popular for a very long time. And a lot of us played, and I had buddies who would open game stores. I had a friend named Howe. He opened a game store for a couple of years. And, you know, we all played Legacy. I mean, we wanted to play with our old cards. You know, that's what makes Magic great. And while not everyone can afford a Legacy deck, Commander now gives people a taste of that. As much as, you know, how old and expensive some of the cards are, the reserve list might irk people. I think in the grand scheme of things, I'm actually one of the people that thinks that they have a role in helping preserve the game and making cards hold value and making people hold interest in old cards. And when you leave the game for a long time and you're like, damn, fetch lands are $85. There was a period where, like, I swear Verdant Catacombs were as much as Underground Seas. And I was trying to tell my friends what the reserve list was, like, buy the Underground Seas, man. These things could be worth more one day, you know? And it was hard for people to believe that. We just needed the fetch lands to play Modern. And I actually found it was, I don't know if it was truly cheaper, but it was really almost cheaper for me as someone who'd held on to some dual lands and some old staples and, you know, Academy Rectors and just, you know, Ancient Tombs and Wastelands, like early cards. It was actually easier for me to get into Legacy than Modern. Buying at the time Tarmogoyfs, you know, Jaces, Lilies, you know, I used a few of those things. I ended up buying one or two Jaces for my Stoneblade deck. But to really build Modern decks, it was very expensive. Circa, I want to say this was maybe like the 2011 to 2016 range, right before Modern Masters and Modern Masters 15 started lowering the price of Goyfs and the meta started changing and Wizards got more active with the ban list for Modern. But at that time, Legacy was still accessible. And we just all loved it, you know? So shout out to everyone who played and to... like I said, my friend Jason at MTG First ran a strong Legacy scene. Level Up ended up buying that store, and they keep that going. And we have a strong Legacy scene, a store in Northern Virginia called Curio Cavern does. But I just loved Legacy. I played it myself, and we stubbornly, in the early days, like I literally texted my friends, come on out to, you know, Wednesday night. Now it's Tuesday night. Come on out to, you know, let's just say Tuesday night Legacy. And I would play, and Jesse would play. And as I started to hire other employees, a friend named Luke Allison, a guy named Chris Lewinsky, who ended up being our inventory manager, they played and we would put butts in seats. We made sure Legacy fire and everyone who tried it loved it. And we've alternated over the years being sanctioned and being unsanctioned. And what we realized is when we were allowing 15 proxies for a long time, we only had one or two people using them. There was like one guy who needed some Ancient Tombs and one literal kid. We would have teenagers like learn Legacy in our store and become very good Magic players. And this one kid at the time named Alex Rubin, who's a good accomplished player now, he needed Volcanics. And people were like, hey man, I'm going to loan you the Volcanics. And we went through the guy who needed the Ancient Tombs binder and we just helped him, as I like to say, trade your trash for treasure, bought a bunch of his, you know, kind of standard rares that were worth money. And he got the tombs and we realized we could sanction it. And at that time, this was almost famous at the time. Now it's probably lost history. The largest, physically largest and most kind of well-known established game store in Maryland was in Glen Burnie. And they were called Games and Stuff. And the owner went on to, I think, sell it. And, you know, he is at Alliance Games now. which is owned by Diamond Comics, the big comic distributor. But at that time, they did Legacy. They allowed proxies, and they famously got some sort of like cease and desist from Wizards lawyers saying you cannot host proxies. And then they tried like playtest cards. Do you kind of remember this era where everyone was like, we can't call them proxies anymore. We need to call them playtest cards. Do you remember that?
It vaguely sounds familiar to me. I remember there was a, you know, it was a kind of like a faux pas, I guess, to even mention it, something right. like that, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, that was because that had happened like half an hour from us at Games and Stuff. You know, there was two cases of Wizards lawyers reaching out to me like, listen, you know, they were streaming Legacy. And what happened is that there were some proxies on the stream and they basically got in trouble. And no shade to them. At the time, we all thought it was fine. And Games and Stuff, again, was one of those Maryland stores helping keep Legacy strong. So we all felt bad about it. But we said, you know what, if this is what we got, if we got to get rid of proxies, we'll get rid of proxies. And instead of the scene dying, it stayed on just as strong. Star City dropped Legacy. Wizards gave Legacy less support. You know, it was an uphill thing, it seemed like, but our Legacy turnouts for like GPDC, I think it was 2018 or so, that was a Legacy. Awesome turnout, you know. Star City does a Legacy event even to this day. Awesome, you know, usually a very good turnout. Eternal Weekend is not far, you know, when the North American Vintage and Legacy Champions left Gen Con and Card Titans started putting on Eternal Weekend with a Wizard sponsorship, that was in places like Pittsburgh and Philly. And it usually is in one of those two cities. I think there was a year it was in Columbus, but we'd go up and play and we'd spread the word. You know, we're playing Legacy every week at our shop. And, you know, when your love's there for it and you know your Magic cards are valuable, at least for people in the DMV, not everyone, but a lot of them were able to parlay their regular collections into Legacy staples. And we have an awesome scene. And one of the best Legacy content creators, you know, a streaming group called the Legacy Pit. And some of those guys played at our store and supported us. We supported them. One of their first big streams was covering that event I mentioned, our revised Legacy Open in February of 2020. They did an awesome stream with us. And we had great coverage. We had Anurag Das on ZMTG. He's one of the best Legacy commentators. We had Mike Noble, who I had met through Eternal Weekend, and he had commentated for Wizards and Card Titan. And we have Jarvis Yu as one of our sponsor players, and he's a great Legacy streamer to watch. And, you know, there's just a lot of good Legacy players in the DMV. So, you know, that's all I can say. I can say a lot about Legacy, but at the end of the day, the people who work at Dice City love the format. We believe in it. And our goal isn't to, like, make it sound so hard to get into and so expensive and exotic. We want to help you get into it. We help people build budget decks. We've loaned people cards or rented people cards. You know, we introduce them to other people who play their deck, who can teach them, how do I build this deck on a budget? You know, and for the longest time, like I said, we allowed proxies. And we end up realizing it might be better for Legacy to have Wizards recording some sanctioned Legacy. And it's certainly better for us if we ever want to do Eternal Weekend trials, which we did for years. So we ended up staying sanctioned for Legacy. And that's been true for, you know, even we were one of the first stores doing CEDH, Competitive Commander, and now we sanction that. And, you know, it became a requirement as we shifted the store during the lockdown. We changed from being a 48 plus seats ready to play Magic into only 24 seats. I think we're back up to 32 now, but we really changed the store around. We put much more emphasis on retail when people couldn't play in the store by state mandate and by Wizards mandate. So we added in more video games and more board games and more D&D. And we, you know, taught people how to link up and play online on web cameras. And at the end of the day, we shrunk the store. So then to keep our numbers up to our old heights, we just had to sanction more things. It wasn't us trying to like deny people using proxies, but we, you know, we've ended up with very few problems with it. You know, those people are able to adapt. And I think it's good for the health of Magic that there are still stores that sanction formats like Legacy and, you know, CEDH. So that's our story. You know, when we do Vintage, we usually do 15 proxies. When we do Old School, we follow the Eternal Central rules, which allow for same art original frame reprints, be it Collector's Edition, Gold Bordered Pro Tour, World Champs, Time Shifted, or Magic 30. We allow all of those. If you want to play a Sarah Angel from, you know, Magic 30, if it's got that retro frame, you're welcome to it, you know. So, I think we just love Eternal Magic at our core, and it's part of our mission statement to keep it alive.
We're going to take a quick break from this podcast to talk about our sponsor, Cardboard Shuffle. Cardboard Shuffle was our 10th podcast interview here at the Match Slip with store owner Mark. Mark has expanded his brand and has produced his own card sleeves called Shuffle Shields. Shuffle Shields come in packs of 100 premium matte card sleeves for standard size trading cards. They contain no PVC and are acid-free. I have 17 packs of Shuffle Shields card sleeves to give away to listeners of the podcast and followers of the Match Slip on social media. Requests for a free pack of card sleeves shipped for free to you will be processed on a first-come, first-served basis. To receive your free pack of Shuffle Shields, you'll need to send a screenshot that you're following Cardboard Shuffle on Facebook to frank@thematchslip.com. Good luck, and back to the episode.
I know you mentioned you played some competitive Magic early on, and I was curious, with owning a store now and being heavily involved in that, what is your relationship with being able to play these days compared to what you maybe used to be able to do?
Oh, man, it's savage. I wish I could play more. In the early days, when things were smaller and we had less walk-in traffic for video games and tabletop games and so on, I would play a bit, and I remained a competent drafter. You know, in my brief accolades, I think I cashed, i.e. top 32, two Star City Standard Opens, and one Star City Classic, which was team sealed. And then in the largest Vintage Champs, which was in that, you know, Eternal Weekend, Pittsburgh era, I got top 64, which was cool because it was about 564 players that year. Then I had some decent legacy showings. I won some old school tournaments, top eighted a bunch. But the more the store went on, the less I got to play. And pretty soon I was only playing, you know, old school a couple times a year at Eternal Weekend, something called the Old School Players Ball in Chicago. I got top eight at that, got a special playmat. That was cool. Music City Old School, I think I got 10th place at something called the Bootleggers Ball. So I'd play and I'd do okay and pretty good and I'd have fun. But I was really at that point more there to grow Dice City's brand and to grow the brand of Old School Magic. I'm hugely passionate about like 1993, 1994 Magic. As I said, I played back then. I kept all my cards. I love the gameplay, the art, the entire play style of that format. And so I basically now mostly just play that. In fact, we had a pretty good weekend this past weekend. You probably don't follow our socials, but definitely check us out on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Dice City Games DC, or just Dice City on Facebook. But we had a really good run. We had a player who was stationed in DC at the Brazilian embassy for a few years named Rubens Campagna, and he just played to second of the regional championship. I think it was in Sao Paulo this past weekend. And so Rubens is going to the Pro Tour. And then I was playing at an event called GloryCon in Pennsylvania. I was undefeated the first seven rounds, first seed in the top eight, and ended up winning in the quarterfinals and then losing in the semifinals to a brutal Twiddle Vault deck, a deck that uses Time Vault, Time Twister, Regrowth, Time Walk, all the restricted cards, and the unrestricted card Recall, not Ancestral Recall, but Recall that lets you discard cards and then draw cards back from your graveyard. It's almost like old school's mini Yawgwill. And off of one of his draw sevens, he drew three Twiddles with a Time Vault in play and proceeded to take four or five straight turns and beat me. But it was a good time. I think I lost that match 1-2, so I did win one of the games. I played Merfolk, which I've been playing since 1993. Before cards were restricted to play sets of four, I had a Merfolk deck that probably played like, I don't know, 11 Merfolk of the Pearl Trident and probably five or six Lord of Atlantis, which themselves were lords. They didn't pump each other. They just pumped the Merfolk. But back then I would play that deck with a bunch of unsummons. And then when Arabian Nights came out, I added Flying Man and Unstable Mutation. Even though they weren't Merfolk, they kept the theme. And with The Dark, I dabbled with Merfolk Assassin. And with Fallen Empires, the deck came more alive with River Merfolk. And I dabbled with things that, you know, that seemed to maybe fit the deck. A card called Vodalion Knights and a card called Seasinger, which were like classic casual staples. But I was glad to see I still had it. So I got third place, but now and then I get to play Magic and it's usually old school.
That's awesome. And congrats on the finish that you had there. That's really good. And I'm sure the professor would love to know that you were playing Merfolk.
Yeah. Haven't seen him in a couple of years, but like I said, he came by our booth once or twice and we had a good time. So
that's great.
Yeah. Merfolk's a great deck. And it's one of the things I love about Magic. It's kind of an any given Sunday. It's not its best right now in any format, but a few years ago I was playing Merfolk in old school and my you know, a guy I became friends with around that time, Joel Lim, ended up winning the Vintage Championship at Eternal Weekend playing Merfolk. and Merfolk was top eating Star City Opens left and right, and it was starting to become a deck in Modern. So there was a point where Merfolk's played in four formats, you know, and then Theros comes out and I'm playing Merfolk in Standard. I've got Master of Waves, you know, I've got Thassa to boost the guys and like make the deck, you know, smoother. And I just like, I love that. I love that Lord of Atlantis was printed in 1993 with that beautiful art by Melissa Benson. And now here we are in 2024, over 30 years later, Lord of Atlantis is still playable in your decks, you know, and there's still an archetype based on it. That's one of the beauties of Magic as a collectible and as a game.
Definitely. It has that nostalgic feel to it. You see things that have this lasting longevity. It's definitely one of the things that's always intrigued me about the game as well. And one of the things you had mentioned earlier regarding, you know, players that you know that, and like you mentioned, that have qualified for the Pro Tour. I know you've mentioned you sponsored some players, which I found very fascinating because I know not every store might have the luxury to afford to do that. And so yep. I wanted to know when in your history of owning the store where you realized that was a feasible thing that you could do to support these players playing.
Yeah, that's a great question, too. You know, I think with Magic, it's always been two things to me. I'm not exclusively into the competitive world or the casual world. As someone who played in 93, 94, I watched the DCI be born. You know, some of my friends have the earliest DCI numbers. You know, the first tournament I held was in my grandparents' living room with us playing on the floor unsleeved with unrestricted cards. My brother had a plague rat deck with like, I don't know, like 20 plague rats in it and a howl of from beyond or something and a couple dark rituals. And I had a friend with, and he also had a lightning bolt deck that he loaned to a guy. And that deck was just tons of lightning bolts. That's kind of what the Alpha 40 format's based on now is those early unrestricted matches. But to go from that where, yeah, I mean, we're playing in a tournament, it's competitive, but we're obviously casual about it. We're kids and, you know, the prize is like pride, you know. My friend Gabe Shalom put on a tournament in his house. And he had a Millstone deck, which blew my mind. Losing to a true control deck with Millstone milling me out was just like unbelievable compared to the creature and burn decks the rest of us were playing in 93, 94. I guess this was after Antiquities came out, probably March 94 or something like that. But, you know, right around that time, competitive Magic started taking off. They did have a barely recorded, you know, Magic Championship in 1994. But in 93 and 94, I guess they you know, kind of tournaments were kind of happening. But even then, the DCI was in its most early stages. So when I look at sponsored players, I always knew there were like better players. You know, there were these players that were just like had names. And I thought, well, one day, you know, if I do a store, I'm going to highlight my friends who are good. Luckily, my friends were good enough to deserve it. So they let me open. Like I said, Joel Sadowski, we sponsored in the beginning. And Joel's a young guy at the time. He's like 19 or whatever. And within a year or two, he's on the U.S. World Magic Cup. He qualifies. You know, you had to go through these WMCQ qualifiers, and he wins one, you know. And I was actually doing pretty good in that tournament. I remember I was in the this was before the top eight, but I was in the top, you know, 8 or 10 tables playing, you know, undefeated or like 5 or 1 or something. And then my shift at the restaurant was coming up and I just had to drop out of the tournament and go work, you know? So that's when I knew I wasn't going to be able to be the guy. But when we opened the store, we sponsored Joel. And then we sponsored, you know, a lot of people. I'll give some shout outs. A young guy named Chase Masters, we've sponsored on and off for a long time. He's currently repping Dice City. Jarvis Yu, who was a local player we didn't sponsor in the beginning, but over the years we picked him up. Dave Long and Rob Long, who were experts with the lands deck. Kurt Spice for maybe a tournament who would help develop the lands deck. As I said, we sponsored TK at one point, who's now the current Legacy champion, you know, for a tournament here and there. A lot of them were like, I do one-offs, and that was easy for me. So it'd be like, I'd give this guy 50 or 100 bucks cash, 50 or 100 bucks in store credit, a pen, a pad, a t-shirt, some Dice City swag, and say, you know, just make a post about us or just wear the shirt. And that grew into some actual, like, chronically sponsored players. And now, last year, about 1 year ago, I think it was last January, February, we had Pro Tour Phyrexia, All Will Be One. And our latest pickup, a guy named Benton Madsen, faced off against Reed Duke in the finals of the Pro Tour wearing the Dice City shirt. So that was awesome, you know. And so we've been recorded on streams, and, you know, people are playing the Dice City shirt in old school streams, legacy streams, vintage streams, standard, modern, pioneer, you know. We had just a bunch of good players. We had a young kid come up named Millen, Millen Bayana, and Millen ended up at 13. I think he either won the legacy event at GP Niagara Falls. I don't know if you remember that, but that was really cool. It was the GP they did over Easter weekend, and a lot of legacy players raged because they're either, you know, people of faith or they're family men or women, or, you know, some of them are Jewish. And like, you've got Easter, you've got Passover, you've got, you know, these major holidays. And it's like, come on, Wizards, you give us a GP for legacy this year. And it's in Niagara Falls on Easter weekend. Come on, that's tone deaf, you know, for who plays legacy. So, but Millen went up there and he kicked butt and he won. I'm trying to remember if it was the legacy GP or the legacy Sunday event. But next week I'm seeing articles in like, the Indian Times News or whatever. I mean, international articles on this 13-year-old who's doing interviews in a Dice City shirt. And so we were honored to have him on the squad for a few years. And I just think it's important for brand growth. You know, we work very hard. I work hard. My team works hard. You see us on the grind. You know, last weekend I'm playing in Glory Con and we've got a sponsored player at a regional championship in South America. This weekend we'll be at Star City Games in Hartford sponsoring players and running a booth. Next weekend we'll be at TCG Con in Houston sponsoring players, running a booth, you know, making deals with artists, commissioning play mats. I mean, branding's big to me. You know, before almost any store I saw do this regularly, we were commissioning play mats. And I'm now proud we've got, I think, 8 play mats in our collection that we commissioned 4 events to commemorate our larger tournaments by the original artists. The guys, when I was 12, 13 years old, Magic came out, I was reading their names on cardboard and trying to imagine who they were. What is Richard Kane Ferguson like? What is, you know, Brian Wackowitz like? What is Jeff Menges like? Anson Maddox, Drew Tucker. Now they're friends of mine, you know, and that's been one of the greatest glories of Magic, is getting to meet these talented players and talented artists and support them. We support the players, we support the artists, you know. And that's the love of the game for me at this stage, is more than playing the game. It's supporting the good people in the community that I can.
And I love that you do attend conventions and you use that for brand recognition. I like just everything you're doing for brand recognition. I think it's very smart and times could be underutilized. And I know since you're going to be doing SCG Con in Hartford this upcoming weekend, and you've done conventions in the past, what has been the biggest net positive you've seen from that? And is it more of coming at it from the lens of a buying collections to then sell when you bring it back home to your store? Or is it more of selling? Like, what is the number one goal when you attend these conventions outside of, say, the brand recognition side, which obviously helps?
Yeah, good question. When I first went into it, it was the brand recognition, and it was just a way to stay connected to the community, because I wasn't going to be going to these tournaments to play competitively anymore. But it allowed me to be there, see how my friends were doing, how our sponsor players were doing, you know, what was in vogue, what was hot, what was on the buy list, what was, you know, top eighting the tournaments. But so it went from brand development and information gathering, frankly, and just participation in the community. And what it grew into over time, I would say, yes, you go to cons to buy, right? There's the conventional narrative is you go to a con to spend more than to sell. You want to come back with cards your local community doesn't have. And of course we do that. And that's our goal. And please bring us your cards. We always have a fair buy list. We usually give 25% more in credit. We have cash, you know, fair buy list. We buy cards. A lot of vendors don't buy. Over the years, vendors have passed on collector's edition, old school, foreign. You know, these cards are coming back in vogue in the past couple of years, but many years people come to us with collector's edition or foreign cards, uncards, whatever that no one else would buy. And I'd be like, cool, I believe in that as a collective. You know, you got a Mox in a box, you got a Chaos Confetti, you know, you got a collector's edition, you know, Black Lotus, you've got a foreign black bordered Korean card that every other vendor's passed on, bring it to me, you know. And of course, the staples, legacy, modern, vintage, old school staples, you know, standard staples, commander staples. But besides buying the cards, I think, and the brand recognition, I think, I guess the Dice City flavor of what comes out of these cons is the show and tell, I like to say. You know, we get, I usually like to bring something special to each con. So for example, we have had recently, I brought some very cool large cards. And I have a Black Lotus that was the vintage championship card. They commission new art and give this large card to represent it. And then you'll see this art on like Magic Online or like the vintage Holiday Cube will have the art. So I've got the Time Walk and the Black Lotus that were given out as prizes in recent years. They just did Black Lotus again. Every few years they'll repeat. So I think there's like maybe 2 Time Twisters and 2 Black Lotuses now and something like that. But these are very valuable artifacts. You know, these are worth thousands of dollars at least, maybe 10,000 plus. I would estimate maybe more in time. These are unique products, which is the most valuable thing. And now I've even heard of people wanting to play with these oversized, these like giant large cards. They want to play Magic. I had a friend sell a Chaos Orb that we ferried to our booth last time, this giant Chaos Orb that my friend Ogre was selling, actually, who was on one of your recent podcasts. And, you know, so we bring something special, be it a large card or an original piece of art. You know, I've gotten into Magic art collecting and selling. We brought the beta sheet out to a couple events. We brought really rare items, like, you know, really rare misprints and art alters and artist proofs that just most booths don't have, you know. That's kind of our angle. We're not the biggest booth. We don't have the most brand recognition in the room. You know, we're still sort of an indie game store. But at the end of the day, we have really cool stuff and we deal in it and we know it and I can authenticate it. I think that's something too. I've shown people when their Chris Rush signatures were fake, you know, or they, you know, authenticated their Garfield signature that they weren't sure about or whatever. That's a skill set that I like to think we have in authentication and verification and then having some of those unique artifacts ourselves. So that's something to always look out for with Dice City on the road.
And how many employees do you currently employ to be able to facilitate everything that you're doing with the store, whether it be on location at the retail location or on the road at a convention?
Okay, great question. So besides myself, I've got Jesse, our director of online commerce and sales, Chris, our inventory manager, Guillermo, our buyer, our admins of acquisitions, and a new employee named Danny, a great guy who's doing our Magic sales and inventory. And then I've got about 12 part-timers who come and go for cons, events. Some are on the road, some are at the store. So at most in the store, I'll have 10 employees working. It's a single location store. We have a little shipping center office. But, you know, it's, you know, 6 to 10 guys working in the store at any given time. But these days I've tried to run it slimmer, closer to the 6. But then we balloon to this larger team of our part-time employees and friends who will help on the road. So this weekend we'll be running the Karlov Manor pre-release, which should be really exciting. I think it's a sleeper set. I think it's going to surprise some people. We've had low pre-orders, which means I expect a high actual in-play demand. That's how it is often. These kind of spontaneous catch fire sets that have come out recently. People had very low expectations for Ravnica Remastered. It sold like hotcakes at Dice City. We drafted it nonstop, you know. So I kind of think Karlov's the next sleeper, sudden, you know, explosion of interest set. And while we're running that, we'll have probably 6 guys working at the shop and you know, 4 or 5 of us on the road. So we'll be 12 people plus working for Dice City this weekend between the road and the shop.
This episode of The Match Slip is sponsored by Crash CityCon, Roanoke, Virginia's premier gaming and fan convention. It's tabletop gaming at its best in addition to role-playing games, board games. There are vendors and so much more. Play with some of the top game masters in the area, enjoy a casual game in their open gaming area, or learn to play games you always wanted to play. Attend Crash CityCon August 23rd through the 25th of 2024 at the Berglund Center Special Events Center. You could check out more information at crashcitycon.com.
What you mentioned with, you know, selling a product and, you know, Ravnica Remastered maybe being under appreciated at the time and then it gets sells really well. I'm curious, in terms of the new direction with booster boxes, with the play boosters, I'm curious how that initial rollout has been for you guys and what your initial reactions are to it with Wizards basically limiting the number of SKUs that they're putting out there in the market.
Yeah. So I'm a fan of limiting SKUs. I think that's good for the game. I am willing to put a lot of faith in Wizards. They do a lot of things wrong. I question a lot of their decisions. I think they've done some corny things. You know, I think when they, you know, when they banned the cards that were controversial, there were many other controversial cards or cards with hurtful art in them that they didn't choose. And it turned out most of those cards were early reserve list cards. They weren't going to reprint or arguably didn't own the art to. And so they do things sometimes for optics. They do things sometimes for, you know, money. And that's business. Like, that's okay. At the end of the day, they've kept Magic alive and strong. So I have many qualms with their decisions here and there on gameplay, BNR lists, you know, SKUs.
But at the end of the day, as much as I was able to buy into and sell this idea, yeah, there's different people and they have different magic needs. So we'll have draft boosters and set boosters and collector boosters and, you know, jumpstart boosters and starter packs and, you know, arena oriented, all this stuff. At the end of the day, it was too much, you know. And so I'm glad to see play boosters. People have been neutral on them so far, which again makes them a great sleeper hit. They're going to have more value in them than old draft boosters did. And hopefully Wizards moves some of the alternative art cards more strictly into collector boosters. I think ever since, at least since Eldraine, you know, Throne of Eldraine, there's been too much showcase art, foil showcase art in regular boosters. It's been a bit much. So I'm hoping what they do here, you know, they're limiting the serialized cards from 500 per of each card to 250. They're limiting the SKUs. They are, you know, they're frankly picking a set that isn't the next Dominaria to roll this out with. So I think that's smart. It's a smart rollout. I think we're going to have a, like I said, a sleeper hit. I don't know if it will be a good set or not, but people like it. They like it for Cube. They like the mechanics so far from what I hear. So I think we're just going to have a pretty neutral play booster rollout that's going to end up being a win in the long run.
And how can you describe for us, for those listening that haven't been to your store before, your store layout, like to paint a visual picture of what it looks like?
Okay. Dice City Games is a big box. It's interesting. I have people that come in and they're like, oh my God, your store is so big. And then I have other people come in, especially people who play there regularly and know our table space is tight. And they're like, man, it's tight in here, you know? And I literally will hear the same thing in one day. Someone new will come in and be like, oh my God, store is so big. It's an illusion. Store is a box. It's a big cube. It has huge ceilings. We've got like, I think 22 foot ceilings in the architectural build out with the drop ceiling. They're like 19 foot ceilings, 18, 19 foot ceilings. So we have more airspace above you in cubic feet than any store I've ever seen. And what's cool about that is it means our walls have tons of space. And so they're covered with shelves holding board games, video games. I monetize every square inch of wall that's at eye level. And then above eye level, it's all paintings, original Magic art, posters, limited prints for Magic artists, retro video game posters, original, you know, pieces of art in the video game community, because that's another really big thing to me is retro gaming, D&D art, you know. And so when you walk into Dice City Games, it's kind of like walking into an LGS and it's kind of like walking into a gallery, because I think we have more art on our walls total, if not certainly per square foot, than any store that I've ever seen or heard of. On top of that, we have a large mural of a Birds of Paradise hand cut from, I think it's either 2,800 or 3,800 original Magic cards, including some cards that are reserve list and probably worth, you know, more than what should go in a scissor cut mosaic. But this big, you know, sort of mosaic mural of Birds of Paradise looks exactly like Birds of Paradise. And this was done pre-AI. A friend of mine who was an advisor in the early days of the store and an L2 judge, Julian Marin, is a big Birds of Paradise collector. He owns some of the different arts of Birds of Paradise and, you know, all kinds of test prints and stuff. And Julian came in, he's like, I have this thing, it's too big to display, and I'll donate it to the store if you're willing to keep it up forever. I said, hell yeah. So we got this Birds that he made in, I want to say, 2012, 2013. It was signed by Mark Poole at Gen Con 2014. And so it hangs, and opposite is another large mosaic of a lightning bolt. And this really colors the store. You walk in and the world's largest magic mosaic is right there on the wall. This, I don't know, 6 or 8 foot by 8 foot Birds of Paradise. You know you're in a magic store. I mean, unless you don't know what Birds of Paradise is, I think everyone who walks in like, wow, I'm in a magic store. And then you've got these 18 foot ceilings covered with paintings and stuff. And then in the center of the store are rows of table. And one thing that was really important to me is I didn't like some of the game store environments I would play in, where they would be these bare bones, like Costco, those gray graphite, plastic, whatever tables everyone has that, you know, your leg gets caught on the folding leg and you know, you're kind of like, you, some stores put two guys per side, some stores put three guys per side, some stores put four guys per side, you know, and they kind of create this almost like locker room magic store feel. I really didn't want that as part of making Dice City welcoming to everyone, feeling clean, being a store that, you know, magic players are playing in, but everyone else can come in and still feel at home if they're shopping for board games or playing D&D or, you know, trying out a retro video game. I wanted a store that didn't hide the magic players in the back, but kind of, and I say this with respect to myself and other Magic players, you know, ask to the best of us. So our Magic players come in, they know people will be shopping around them. They're not hidden in the back. They're not speaking very foul. It's not like they're not throwing insults at each other. It's a really good store culture. And other shoppers come in and mingle with them. And, you know, they play in the tables and they're surrounded by walls of video games, board games, D&D and Magic and Pokemon. So that's the motif. And we even had a couple guys come from a game store in Slovenia, to my surprise. They said they were thinking of applying for Guinness Book of World Records for having the largest Magic mosaic in their store. They measured ours. Turns out ours was larger. So I really do need to call Guinness.
Sounds like a perfect opportunity for you right there.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about, and you can take this in whichever direction you'd like to go, but like, what's one thing right now that's working versus what's not, you know, positive, negative of owning a store?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Regarding trials and tribulations, you know, I want to share this with my customers. So I don't want to overshare because I want them to listen to this. I want them to feel heard and loved. You know, Dice City is really, really a community game store at the end of everything. We came from the Magic and board game community. We serve the Magic and board game community. And again, I cannot understate, you know, retro video games as part of my identity, my, you know, the subculture I'm a part of. You know, I'm a sort of expert on retro video games. I'm probably the biggest or one of the biggest collectors in the DC area. And I love them. I see an intersection between them and Magic, like I do between, you know, Tolkien and D&D and Warhammer and Magic. I see all these intersections that exist. And I would say one of the obstacles is, you know, you can't be everything to everyone. And so I think that a lot of LGSs are LGSs at the end of the day, and not to sound self-important, but I like to think Dice City is more. So we are at our crux, a local game store. But where we change is we try to be less dictated by the whims of, you know, the distributors or of Wizards of the Coast or of the other card game makers or of YouTubers pushing whatever game it is. You know, MetaZoo just failed, right? You know, Lorcano is a great game, but it's really about my curation and our aesthetic and our goals. And so there's a positive and a negative that comes with that. The negative is that some people want us to host everything under the sun. I mean, they want us hosting X-Wing, Warhammer, D&D, Pathfinder. They want us hosting DIY RPGs. They want us hosting, for sure right now, Lorcano, One Piece, you know, Keyforge. You know, we get asked about so many games. And you could do them all, but each game comes at a cost. It comes with either buying that game singles or not and investing in them. It comes with keeping that game stocked. It comes with having a judge or some sort of rules master on hand to learn the game. It comes with working on your schedule to find space for that game. And it comes with serving that game's community and knowing them and being authentic. We can't do it all, and I didn't set out to do it all. Dice City Games is, at the end of the day, Magic the Gathering, retro video games, and those two are at the top. And then after them, D&D. And I don't even say RPGs. I say D&D. Of course, we have other RPGs, but I don't want people to expect every RPG. And I don't say TCGs. I say Magic and Pokemon. And then I don't say video games. I say retro video games. You know, we're not here to sell you, you know, Xbox Series S and, you know, PS5 games. That's not what we do. And board games, not tabletop games, because even though I love Warhammer, we don't have space for it. We don't do it really. We just do, you know, the board games that we curate that we think are good for our customers. And so I think that's one of the challenges is you can't do everything for everyone. Space is limited and you can't be an expert in everything. So I'd rather be an expert in 5 things I love than half-ass 25 things to make 25 different gaming communities half happy. So that's the challenge. You know, and because of that, you get lower allocations, or if you order something late, you can fall really behind. You know, like we ended up getting a good healthy amount of Lorcana ultimately, but in the beginning it was touch and go. And that's happened. We've supported usually 1/3 game. So I talk about our pillars of Dice City, the ones I just mentioned, Magic and then Pokemon. And Pokemon we support more as a collectible than as a game. We held Pokemon Sunday weekly meetups and we plan to do them again in the future. But right now we're on a Pokemon game hiatus. That said, we're one of the best stores for Pokemon collectors. People come in all the time, buy product. We deal in high-end slabs, vintage steel product. You know, in the DMV, we're one of the better stores. With the third pillar, I've done in the early days, we did Card Fight Vanguard. We did a game called Light Seekers where the creator of the game came and pitched it to us. We did Flesh and Blood. We did Keyforge, I should say, before Flesh and Blood. Then we did Flesh and Blood. You know, we dabbled in Lorcana and One Piece, and now it's Sorcery. So you might find on our shelves we'll have some convenience packs in One Piece or Lorcana, but we're not holding events. But Sorcery is an old school Magic style game with original Magic artists, and it's hard to get product for it, which makes it hard to host events. But we are tending to host Sorcery about bi-weekly right now, both mixing in Constructed and Draft. I think it has a lot of potential. It is not overhyped, which is good. It has a lot of organic growth from the Magic community, particularly old school Magic players or people who follow Magic art. And the company's doing a lot of things right. So that's my shout out to Sorcery. But at the same time that I can make some Sorcery players happy, I don't have enough product for all of them. And at the same time that I can make those guys happy, I'm disappointing maybe the One Piece players because we don't consistently have One Piece. So end of the day, you can't make everyone happy. Do what you do best. And in our case, that's curating the type of games, inventory, and experiences we love.
That's a smart way to go about it. It keeps you also interested in doing what it is you're doing rather than getting bored when you're kind of siloed into so many areas you can't keep them all together.
Yeah.
So I think it's great that you've went with that approach. One final thing I was wondering was regarding what you said early in the podcast, you mentioned that you had done filmmaking before, and I was curious if you parlayed that into branding opportunities from a video standpoint for the store for YouTube.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's something I think about monthly, if not weekly. We have not. And the crazy thing is that I was a video producer and, Jesse, our director of online commerce and stuff, he has a sound recording background and we have all kinds of talented friends. But at the end of the day, you got to run the store. And it's crazy to think that there are some people who make more money on YouTube than they do out there doing this. But to me, being in person, meeting customers, hosting events, going to cons, that's all part of the fabric of life of what it is. I can't just be a talking head behind the camera. That said, I'd like to think I'm good at it. And I'd like to think we're going to find some magical time where things slow down and we do more video content. We've partnered with some great people. So you can find content of us if you know how to search on YouTube. We've posted a couple videos on YouTube, maybe literally like two, I think, two or three. But the best things, if you looked up the revised Legacy Open with the Legacy Pit, you could find that event. If you looked up Coven MTG, Dice City Old School, you'd find some of that. The events we did at Silver Branch Brewery where we had Old School Magic, Old School Commander. We have some events that are up and we have a lot of things pending. We've shot a lot of footage over the years that we're looking for time to edit. So if you're an editor who wants to work at a friendly rate, please reach out to me, jimmy@dicecity.games. I can produce and script and, kind of envision videos, but I can do very basic editing, but we're looking for a talented editor to put together our videos because our YouTube content is going to be crazy. And I really think one day we'll look back at this interview and our YouTube channel will be incredibly popular because the wealth of knowledge, frankly, that I have and the people associated with me have on Magic, on Pokemon, on retro video games and on the other hobbies that we're a part of is really second to none. I mean, it's really tier one of what game store, people know. We're up there with the best of them knowing our stuff. And so I'd love to take time to be on YouTube. And I'm open to interviews like this if anyone's interested. You know, we're always happy to do one. I've done a few interviews, a great podcast that an old school guy named Brian Manolakis does. You can find me on his podcast. You can find me on a podcast, a guy named Tom Flynn did, and you can find some of our videos on YouTube, but, I think his podcast is called All Things Considered. There's a couple early episodes with me talking about old school Magic, but at the end of the day, that's kind of in the future. And it is tough. You have to choose every day, man, I could have a lot of fun making videos and be popular with the YouTube crowd, but I got to go to the store and make sure, that the tournament fires well and the customers are happy and we didn't spend too much on video games today or, bulk stuff.
Yeah, no, it's completely understandable. So my last question for you, Jimmy, is what is one future wish you have for the store? And it could be anything that is on your mind. It could be something, if you want to do the pretend scenario of, money's not an option, or if you have a more financially sound idea that the store can afford to do, anything that has been on your mind that you've been looking to maybe do in the near future or in the distant future for the store?
Yeah. I'll give you two instead of one, because that's how my mind works. One thing is getting back to doing our huge events. The past 2 years, a guy named Jason Jaco, who runs the blog Eternal Central and the website eternalcentral.com, he cultivated the most popular old school rule set for old school magic in North America. And then he's an admin of a Facebook group I run called North American Old School Magic. It's designed to be a hub for clubs to post their events and tournament reports and upcoming things that people can participate in. That's been fun. After Eternal Central stopped hosting old school events during Eternal Weekend, he sort of passed the baton off to me. And then through North American Old School Magic and Dice City, we've been hosting the old school North American Old School Cup. It's every Thursday night leading into Eternal Weekend. So that's hard for some people to make, but it's a blast. We had 50 as our cap last year and hit it. We had 64 as our cap this year and hit it. We have a lot of people playing old school and then going right into a long ass weekend of Vintage and Legacy. In that vein, instead of doing those events in Philly and Pittsburgh like we've done the past couple of years, we're planning to get back to our larger offsite events. I'm working with our sponsor player, Jarvis Yu, right now. Who sadly lost his father to cancer recently. We're working on an event that will be a benefit for cancer survivors. And we're working on a couple other big tournaments that I can't announce yet. So getting back to big offsite events is in the cards. In the meantime, we've been running 1Ks in the store, capping them at 32 people. We've got a legacy 1K coming up, a modern 1K coming up, an RCQ coming up, and the old school St. Patrick's Day FLA on Sunday, March 24th, which is an awesome, you know, Irish-themed St. Patrick's Day party and old school magic event at the shop. Now, after that, the big offsite events you have to hear to. Second thing I want to do, and this is the thing that will be the long, long evolution of Dice City or my personal self, I believe that there is a connection between these games and other collectibles and gaming history and Americana. And so I love when I see people who really, you know, value the knowledge behind it, be it, you know, people like, I don't know, the magic historian or, you know, the professor, or more importantly, even outside of magic, the comic historians that are out there, you know, the people, you know, behind Heritage Auctions and behind the grading companies. You know, I met the head grading staff of CGC, it's a video game department, and this guy has a collection is bigger than mine, which is like unbelievable, you know, and loves it, loves video games, loves the history, you know. And when I look at the future of collectibles, I'm a huge buff for things besides magic, as I mentioned. Retro video games, old school Warhammer, movie posters, cinema, DVDs, Blu-ray, vinyl records, VHS, old books, old movie posters, American history, militaria. And I see us being a force in the collectibles community long term. So I won't say exactly what that looks like yet, but if you one day end up with Dice City Games, Dice City Video, Dice City Cinema, Dice City Americana, Dice City Cars. I mean, this could happen. So we'll see what path it takes. But I just think that the whole wide world of collectibles, they all really tell the story of the world and of America. And, you know, the glory days when people have money for hobbies and, you know, what do they choose to do their money with and how do they grow it? And where does the subculture grow out from? So that's what you'll eventually see from us is tying magic into this broader fabric that I see as the collectible gaming world and the collectible world.
And I very much look forward to seeing how it all plays out. I love the ideas. It's a lot of stuff that appeals to me as well. Jimmy, I have to tell you, it's been great having you on the program today. You're a fantastic storyteller, and I really enjoyed learning, as I hope the audience has as well, hearing about how the store came to be and all the awesome things that you're doing with it now. So again, thank you for coming on the program.
Awesome. Well, Frank, thanks for having me. I really look forward to listening to it and learning more about your podcast. And I think you're doing a gift for the community. You know, last thing I'll say to the customers, the viewers, the listeners, the people out there, your local game store is essential. Game stores prop up the game more than Wizards of the Coast does, more than large tournament circuits do. Game stores are the lifeblood of the community. Thank your game store owners. Thank their staff. Treat your other players with respect. You know, we enrich the players around us. I always give them tips. I've helped my customers become a better player than me. You know, I used to be a good drafter. I teach them how to draft. Now they'll outdraft me. You know, that's the fabric. It is a community. You grow it, you foster it, you steward it. That's what we're here to do. And it sounds like you're doing that just by letting us game store owners have a voice. So thank you so much. I look forward to talking to you again someday.
I appreciate it. And I'm more than happy to do it and would definitely love to talk to you again in the future. Where can people find the store if they haven't checked it out before?
Great question. So definitely check us out. We've got a couple ways to get in touch right now. Our URL, we do have a website. I often hide it. I'm a perfectionist. So you won't see a regular website, but dicecity.games, www.dicecity.games directs to our Facebook right now. You can also find us at https tcg.dicecity.games. That directs to our TCG seller store, our pro TCG store, and on tcgplayer.com, where you can shop exclusively from us. That tends to be our overstock. So if you check out our TCG store, we have so much more in store. Come visit us in the Washington, D.C. suburbs in Silver Spring, Maryland. Check us out on Twitter and Instagrams at dicecitygamesdc. And then check us out on Facebook at just Dice City, which again, our website will, our URL will get you to that. So definitely follow us, say hi, and spread the word.
Awesome. And I'll be sure to have all of that in the show notes. Again, thank you for coming on, Jimmy. It's been a pleasure having you.
Thank you. And you will see us. We do have a YouTube, so you can follow us there for now, and you'll see more content in the coming year. All right.
Yep, definitely look forward to that. And for everybody else listening, I want to thank you for taking the time to listen to the episode today. If you'd be interested in joining our newsletter at thematchslip.com/newsletter, I share my personal experiences at the game stores I visit throughout the country. So feel free to check that out if it's of interest to you. With that being said, I look forward to talking to you all in the next episode, and take care.